Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
Voting has begun in elections to regional assemblies and one-third of the seats in the Czech Senate. Thursday saw a new one-day record rise in COVID-19 cases, and the Czech economy experienced a fall of 10.9% in the second quarter of 2020. Voting began in elections to regional assemblies and one-third of the seats in the Czech Senate on Friday afternoon. Some people in quarantine for COVID-19 have already voted in special drive-in polling centres and with mobile electoral commissions. However, the main voting began at 2 p.m. on Friday, with polling stations remaining open until 10 p.m. before again welcoming voters from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday. The Senate elections operate on a two-round system. If no candidate receives over 50% of the vote in the opening weekend, the two frontrunners will enter a runoff in a week's time. Some 3,493 new cases of COVID-19 were registered in the Czech Republic on Thursday. This is a new one-day record rise in infections and brings the total number of active cases to 39,391. According to the latest data, there are 1,028 people in Czech hospitals with the coronavirus, with 198 of them in a critical condition. 12 deaths with COVID-19 were recorded on Thursday. There have been 678 since the start of the pandemic. The Czech economy experienced a fall of 10.9% in the second quarter of 2020, according to revised data released by the Czech Statistics Office on Friday. The statistics is the worst in the history of the independent Czech Republic and was primarily caused by the restrictive measures connected to the coronavirus pandemic. Estimates predicted a year-on-year fall of 10.7% and a quarter-on-quarter of 8.4%. According to experts, the quarter-on-quarter GDP is expected to increase again after most restrictions on economy activity have been lifted. The annual ceremony honoring victims of the Holocaust at the former Terezín concentration camp in central Bohemia has been cancelled, the spokesman of the Terezín Memorial, Tomáš Rieger, said on Friday. The event, which traditionally takes place every year on third Sunday of May, had been postponed until mid-October due to the coronavirus outbreak. However, in view of the current state of emergency, it has been called off. Between 1940 and 1945, more than 150,000 people, mostly Jews, passed through the Terezín ghetto on their way to Nazi extermination camps. 117,000 of them did not live to see the end of the war. The Premier League side West Ham have signed the Czech Republic's defender Vladimír Coufal for a fee of around 5.5 million British pounds. The 20-year-old right back, who joins the club from Slavia Prague, has signed a three-year deal until the summer of 2023 with a two-year option. The defender, who won two Czech titles since joining Slavia in 2018, has played in the Champions League and was a member of the Czech team that beat England last year. He will be joining his former Slavia and current national team colleague Tomáš Souček, who signed permanently to the London club at the end of July. And finally, a quick look at the weather. Saturday is expected to be sunny or partly cloudy, with occasional rain showers and storms predicted in the late afternoon and evening. Temperatures will range between 21 and 25 degrees Celsius. I'm Ruth Franíková, and that's the end of the news.
You're listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's programme, Czechs are voting in regional and Senate elections amid strict security measures to prevent a further massive spread of the coronavirus. And we'll look at a newly released documentary about the Tap Tap Band, formed two decades ago as a creative outlet for disabled children. Later on, you can hear the second part of a story how an SS officer's armchair uncovered the hidden life of a Nazi stationed in occupied Prague. Stay with us for that. Czechs have started voting in elections to regional assemblies and a third of seats in the Senate. The elections are taking place amid tight security measures aimed at preventing a further spread of the coronavirus epidemic, which has significantly worsened in recent weeks. Go to the polls and use your right to shape the future of this country. That is the message politicians across the board have been sending voters in the run-up to the elections. There is no doubt at all that the main issues generally highlighted in regional and Senate elections have been significantly overshadowed by two aspects of the coronavirus crisis: health safety matters and economic concerns. On the day that polling stations opened to the public, the Health Ministry reported the highest daily increase since the start of the epidemic in March. Close to 3,500 people registered COVID-19 positive. This has led to fears of a low turnout and resulted in unprecedented security measures at polling stations around the country. I can assure you that casting your ballot will be safer than a trip to the supermarket, Interior Minister Jan Hamáček told the public on the eve of the elections. The security measures implemented have led to the elections being held in a phased-out regime. On Wednesday and Thursday, people who are COVID-19 positive and those in quarantine cast their votes in special drive-in points operated with the assistance of the army. Those who cannot leave their homes or people in hospitals and old age homes could avail themselves of the services of mobile electoral commissions. However, the main voting, spread out over 2 days, is taking place on Friday from 2 p.m. until 10 p.m. and on Saturday from 8 until 2, likewise amid tight security, as Klára Dlubalová from the Interior Ministry explains.
Voters must enter the polling station with a face mask. Only a few people will be allowed in at a time, and they will be expected to use a sanitation gel placed at the entrance. Voters will stand at a safe distance from the commission and will be asked to remove their face mask for a few seconds for identification purposes.
Members of the commission who handle IDs will change their protective gloves after every voter, and the voting booths will be constantly disinfected by personnel. Face masks and sanitizers will be there in stock for voters should they request them. According to preliminary estimates, the extra safety precautions will cost approximately 1 million crowns. 85 parties and movements are running in elections to 13 regions, and 235 candidates are running for seats to a third of the Senate. Polling stations close at 2 p.m. on Saturday, and preliminary results should be available late that afternoon, depending on voter turnout. Radio Prague will be following the elections closely, of course, so do tune in to our program or check out our webpage over the weekend. Moving on now, sex, drugs and rock and roll on wheels. That's the tagline for a newly released documentary about the Tap Tap. A Czech band formed 2 decades ago as a creative outlet for students at the Jedlička Institute, a renowned Prague school for the disabled. The film, shot over several years, promises a politically incorrect behind-the-scenes look at life on and off the road for the band. Brian Kennedy has more.
The title of the new Tap Tap documentary in Czech is Postižený muzikou, which translates roughly into English as Disabled by Music, but is being released internationally under the less provocative title of Two Roads. Director Radovan Sibert has made several music videos for the Tap Tap over the past decade and come to know band members especially well over the past 4 years of shooting. With Disabled by Music, he hopes to challenge stereotypes while avoiding maudlin representations and film clichés. So the often dark or politically incorrect humour throughout the film, Siebert told Czech Radio, is entirely the band's own.
Je to nekorektní humor, který vychází od členů kapely The Tap Tap.
The politically incorrect humor comes from members of the Tap Tap, not from me. The film certainly doesn't make fun of disabled people, and I didn't set out to make a politically incorrect film. There are certain stereotypes about how people with handicaps live, but they live much like the rest of us and don't want to be pitted. In that sense, it could be seen as somewhat politically incorrect.
Takže možná kvůli tomu to může být lehce vnímaný jako nekorektní.
Most of the dozen or so regular members of the Tap Tap are in wheelchairs and have serious disabilities. But despite the difficulties of taking the show on the proverbial road or the coronavirus pandemic, they often played some 60 concerts a year and have performed in London, Madrid, Moscow, Jerusalem, New York, Washington, and Chicago. In the early years, the Tap Tap played mainly cover songs, but now compose originals that speak to the disabled world or their personal experiences, such as The Sad Optimist by singer and electronic percussionist Jana Augustinova. It's about playing cards that fate has dealt you with a smile, hopefully a contagious one, on your face. That said, Miss Augustinova, who has been in the band nearly since its inception and is among the central protagonists in the documentary, told Czech Radio that being filmed over so many years in so many situations was something of a mixed bag.
Bylo to určitě těžký a filmaři to se mnou měli těžký.
It was definitely difficult and the filmmakers had a hard time with me because sometimes I really didn't want some scenes to be shot. But I think we found a good compromise. Although a lot of great material wasn't included, I think it's a great film and we enjoyed the premiere. I hope also that people who maybe didn't know us before will really enjoy it.
Doufám, že i lidi, co se na něj podívají a třeba nás neznají, se budou bavit.
The documentary Disabled by Music, which won the Audience Award at the Jihlava International Documentary Film Festival last year, is in Czech cinemas now.
Brian Kennedy with that report, and Brian stays with us now for our main feature here on Radio Prague International.
Historian Daniel Lee is a specialist in the history of Jews in France and North Africa during the Holocaust. His latest book, The SS Officer's Armchair, is the story of a German lawyer named Robert Griesinger, who joined the Gestapo, served in the Wehrmacht, and then in occupied Prague, where he met his death. In the first part of this interview, we learned how a cache of Griesinger's documents, found hidden in an armchair, compelled Daniel Lee to research the life of this ordinary Nazi to better understand the inner workings of the Third Reich. He would learn that the SS officer's father had been born in New Orleans to a German-American family that owned enslaved people. He would also come to know Griesinger's two daughters, Jutta and Barbara, living in Germany and Switzerland, and a nephew with a trove of writing kept by Griesinger's mother.
Yeah, Robert emerges from the voices of others very, very often. You know, I wasn't able to find his diary, if he had ever kept one. But fortunately, it's so rare for a historian to even have this. You know, his mother, I was able to track down eventually the family in Stuttgart, living in the same house where Robert had grown up as a young man. This beautiful, enormous house that didn't look like any of the other houses in the area, because it turned out that Robert's father was American from New Orleans, and he wanted his house to serve as a sort of reminder to his Southern American heritage. The architect's plans really showed, the blueprint were deliberately meant to resemble a Southern plantation. So having access to this house was fantastic. After several visits, the family trusted me and I was able to sort of rummage around and look for things. And then one day I found tons of his mother's correspondence and diaries and all kinds of things that she'd kept that really gave you know, she kept a diary of her son from the day he was born until the day he went to university. Every day she's taking to her diary, and she's also writing about the First World War, because he was born in 1906, so he was a child during the war. It's very important that he, you know, he formed part of this war youth generation, these young men born between 1900 and 1910 who didn't fight in World War One. The end of the war in 1918, it was just the total collapse of everything. You know, his entire, we're talking about an entire generation that was shaped by the devastating experience of the First World War and the national humiliation that followed. So I had access to his mother's diary, which gave obviously a lot of insight into his personality. And then later when I could interview his daughters, obviously having access to his official correspondence. So when he was working in the Gestapo in the 1930s, when he was working in Nazi-occupied Prague in the 40s at the Ministry of Economics and Labour, again, I was able to get more of his voice through the official bureaucratic documents.
With that diary as a roadmap, Daniel Lee tracked Gleason-Gehr's trajectory from an unremarkable, pampered schoolboy during the First World War to an ambitious, politically engaged teenager and later law student at Tübingen University, then Germany's most reactionary seat of learning, full of students and professors alike, yearning for a resurgent fatherland under Hitler.
1925, he went to Tübingen University. He joined a student fraternity, one of these very right-wing fencing associations, which explains how he got his scar on his cheek. And a lot of these men from Tübingen actually ended up in Prague during the war. It was actually thanks to this Tübingen connection that he was able to transfer to Prague, something which a lot of specialists hadn't really considered, these links between Stuttgart and Prague during the Second World War. So these were very, very important to him, the connections that he made as a young man. And as I've said, they came in very handy for him as he's trying to climb up the ladder during the Nazi years.
Right. His daughters were, I guess, in their 70s when you spoke to them.
Yeah.
They were very forthcoming and very eager to learn, as you learned, to pass on your information because he was such a blank for them. But you write that the more and more documents you got your hands on or other sources, the more complicit you realized he was, the more of a desk murderer, as you put it. Could you tell me a bit about the ministry that he worked for in Prague?
Yeah. So after he left, so in the 1930s, he was at the Gestapo in Stuttgart as a lawyer. He was always working basically with legal questions throughout his career as a civil servant. He fought in the Second World War in the Wehrmacht, first in France and then in Russia, and got wounded there. And after he was getting better in Stuttgart in 1942, he got posted to Prague thanks to his connections, his very, you know, these brilliant connections he's formed at university. And he's working at the Ministry of Economics and Labour, which is a really, really important ministry in Nazi-occupied Prague. As you know, and all of your and your listeners will know, that a lot of the purpose of the protectorate economically was to transform the protectorate and make it work for the German war effort. A lot of factories suddenly became under German control. A lot of people were sent away to do forced labor, either in different parts of the protectorate or in Nazi Germany and Austria. So it was very, very important that these businesses were functioning properly. And that's, from the legal point of view, that's really what Gleason-Gehr was in charge of, making sure everything was going to plan. For example, on one occasion, he was very cross with Bulgaria because the protectorate was producing a lot of glass at that time, but this glass had to be sent back to the protectorate in order to be recycled and used. You know, there was a massive glass shortage. And I remember at one point in the archives laughing because, you know, he'd written such a strongly worded report talking about Bulgaria just not doing their recycling. It's the kind of language I just wasn't expecting a Nazi from the 1940s to be using. So these are the kinds of things that he would be doing. He'd be closing down, making sure Czech-owned businesses were being closed or that they were working entirely for the war effort and that people would be rounded up wherever possible and being sent away to do forced labor in just terrible conditions in Germany. The Czech workers who were sent there were often, the factories were very close to the railway lines, and so when the Allied bombs were being dropped, these Czech workers were often the first ones to fall victim. And, you know, this is, of course, he has a responsibility in all of this.
Right. And you, if I remember correctly, you managed to identify and find one of the Czech maids who worked for the family, a German speaker, or her daughter, I guess it was, and a lot of other kind of tangential people in his life.
Right.
But for the most part, people, understandably, I guess, are very reluctant to speak to you, to have any connection to their homes where this particular Nazi lived, to have any connection in print to their own homes.
I found that was the case in the Czech Republic. I didn't find that anywhere else, to be honest. I found, like, I mean, I don't think I answered your question properly before about his daughters, who I managed to strike up a relationship with, and they were very more than cordial. They were extremely open. They wanted me to, you know, pursue this story about their father as much as they could. They were fully on board from the start. So, of course, I would be invited to their home. I would interview them time and time again to find out as much as I could from them about their father. But often, you know, we would have a role reversal at certain points, and then they would start to ask me lots of questions about their father, again, which was very unusual for a historian. But no, I found that in, for example, I tried to gain access to the house that he had lived at in Prague, because he and his wife and children, they lived in Prague for a couple of years during the Second World War. And of course, Prague would have, as you know, would have been this dream posting for any German official. You know, the best German theater, cinema, music, etc. was in Prague. Allied bombs couldn't even reach Prague. So, you know, he was able to lead a wonderful life, and his daughters could go to the, you know, the most wonderful German schools.
You write about some of the papers you found relating to holidays, visiting relatives in Liechtenstein and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you were also struck just by sort of normal family life, how much on the surface it at least seemed to be a normal life during this occupation, during the height of the war. And
that was definitely something that struck me a lot, the kinds of things that he and his wife and children would be doing, how life really did seem to go on. And as I've already said, you know, they were in this privileged position as being Germans, and they had all the extra rations, access to food and other materials, which the local Czech population obviously could not have. So no, life was very, very good for this family, for most German families, you know, the parties, the socializing that the parents went to. And yeah, some of the memories the children have are very fond memories of that time, of their parents being very happy in Nazi-occupied Prague. You know, they really thought, of course, that Germany was going to win the war. For months and months and months after D-Day, and the feeling was such that people thought that Hitler was somehow going to turn things around. I found one document in the armchair that showed that the entire family had gone on holiday in July 1944, so weeks after D-Day. They went to Liechtenstein, which is where Griesinger's wife's family were living, her parents, his parents-in-law. You know, I remember being with one of his daughters, Barbara, and she just couldn't get over the fact that they returned after D-Day. They went back to Nazi-occupied Prague. You know, why didn't he stay? Why didn't he stay? You know, her life would have been completely different if he didn't go back. You know, but he obviously felt this loyalty to his employer, his boss at the ministry, and this belief that somehow Germany was going to win the war. And let's not forget, the alternative would have been terrible. The alternative was the communist menace, which for somebody like Griesinger with his background, you know, it would have been totally unthinkable. Anyway, they lived in Bubenec in Prague. And I tried to visit the house they had lived at. I got the address and I sort of rung on the bell and nobody answered. A couple of times I tried this, so I left a note. But eventually the current owner just wrote to me and said, we just don't want to be caught up in a story about the Nazis. And I understand that. I totally understand that. They, you know, it's a shame because it would have been wonderful to sort of get a sense, a spatial sense of, you know, the domestic arrangements of that house in Prague, not least to take some pictures and be able to look at with the daughters to see what kind of memories that might provoke. But otherwise, yeah, I managed to track down his maid, which was that took me ages to figure out, you know, out of all the maids in Nazi-occupied Prague, how on earth was I going to find the one that had happened to live in his house? But I managed to do it.
A a passport issued in Prague to Robert Schlesinger in June 1944, valid for 1 year, found in the SS officer's armchair, was likely hidden during the liberation of May 1945, a time when, after 6 years of the occupation, sections of the Czechoslovak population took part in sporadic killings. Schlesinger, too old for regular military service, had joined the Volkssturm, a civilian militia founded in late 1944. But was he captured? Did he surrender? How did he die?
There are still quite a few mysteries connected with this particular Nazi. In the beginning of the book, it seemed that he had been shot either by Czechs or Soviet troops.
Yeah.
And then later we find that he, in all likelihood, died in hospital of disease. Could you tell me some of the burning questions, like what kind of kept you up at night as you were finishing the book?
That was, of course, one question. How did he die? Because his nephew in Stuttgart, who, you know, a man in his 80s, was totally convinced that his uncle had been shot in Prague at the liberation. Robert Schlesinger's mother was desperate to find out what had happened to her son, and she had a Czech neighbor in Stuttgart who she paid and sent to Prague in 1946 to really do her homework and find out exactly what had happened to Schlesinger. And so after several weeks, this neighbor returned to Stuttgart and with some earth from a cemetery in Prague, where she said to the family that Robert Schlesinger had been murdered in a hospital in Prague and his body was thrown into a mass grave. Now, you know, we know that stuff like this was happening in spring 1945 all across the Czech lands. This was not uncommon that there were reprisals against the Germans after six. You know, a lot of Czechs decided to unleash some vengeance and take their revenge. So we do know that lots of Germans were being killed at that time. And there were other atrocities taking place as well. I mean, you know, a drop in the ocean when we compare what the Czech people had suffered during the 6 years of occupation, the amount of physical and mental anguish that they had at the hands of Heydrich and others, especially following Heydrich's assassination. But nevertheless, these outbreaks and incidents did occur in spring 1945 against the German population and Nazis who had found themselves in the Czech lands. It was up to me to discover whether or not he had been killed or, like it said in his official death certificate, which I found in Prague, whether he had died in a hospital. And just speaking to experts and visiting archives, you know, it was very clear that a lot of people who were killed in hospitals at that time, it never said on their death certificate, killed in a hospital. It would say, you know, some kind of horrid illness. So you know, diphtheria or dysentery or something like that, whooping cough. It was recorded as the cause of death, but often, nevertheless, people were being killed. So, I heard time and time again stories of Germans being led to the top floor of a hospital building and then thrown off the roof, either by the Red Army or by Czech partisans, while other partisans would be at the bottom with their guns pointing upwards. And it would be a sort of competition to see whether the German would be killed by bullets or whether he would hit the floor first. So I tried my best to try and answer this question, but I knew it would always be a very, very hard and sort of complex area to get any certainty on. Eventually, you know, I ended up at Dablice Cemetery in Prague, which, according to lots of sources, indicates that that is his final resting place because he was killed or he died there in September 1945.
That feature was prepared and presented by Brian Kennedy, and it's brought us to the end of today's programme from Radio Prague. You'll find us at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, our email address is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you. And remember, you can also follow Radio Prague on Facebook and Twitter. This is Danielle Lazarová saying thanks for joining us today and take care.